Does this circumstance sound familiar to anybody here? It's expressed in a poem that reads this way. I think that I shall never see the dollar that I loaned to thee. A dollar that I could have spent on many forms of merriment. The one I loaned to you so gladly is now the one I need so badly. For whose return I had great hope, just like an optimistic dope. For dollars loaned to folks like thee are not returned to fools like me. It's from a Dear Abby letter a number of years ago, and it expresses a common sentiment, I think, that people understand, that money woes seem to be a common human condition. We seem to never have enough of it, or think we don't have enough money. And many believe, and I think there was a big lottery winner just yesterday in California, wasn't there? A lady who won 200 plus million, I believe. Many believe that more money would solve all their problems, that whatever their major problems are, they would be solved by more money. It is interesting to take note of how much the Bible has to say about money. And there's one question in particular, one subject in particular related to this in the Bible that does raise eyebrows and generates questions. Just in the last probably 6 months, I've had several requests from members in one of the other three congregations to give some sermons or Bible studies on this subject, because some say they haven't heard a sermon on the subject in many years. Some of the newer ones in the church said they've never heard a sermon on the subject. I looked back at my notes and found I haven't given one in about 15 years on this particular subject. Again, that generates a number of questions. Just in the last week, personal correspondence department received the following questions, and it gives you the information about what that subject is related to finances. But these questions came into personal correspondence. A person obviously new to the Church of God asked us to explain the purpose of second tithe. The subject, tithing. Asked us to explain the purpose of second tithe, including whether it should be paid to the church. Another new contact asked us to define increase in regard to tithing, whether the tithe should be paid on the net or the gross, and whether it's acceptable for a business owner to deduct expenses. Lastly, we received questions from two members of CAGWA about third tithe. They were not aware of the church's teaching and practice on this subject, which was established back in 1996 with, you may remember, an administrative decision that was made. What about the doctrine of tithing? Why do we teach in the Church of God what we teach about the subject of tithing? What about this matter of first tithe and second tithe and third tithe? Where did those ideas come from in the Scriptures? Where did we find those ideas? Where did we find those concepts? And what is our practice today? What is our teaching today? People have asked, well, what does the church teach today about tithing, about third tithe, about how we tithe, about saving feast tithe or second tithe? What does the church teach about these things? As an overview, I would say that it's important to understand that the doctrine of tithing, as taught by the Church of God, has never changed. It's never changed. Now, the administration of tithing has changed from time to time to help address problems with tithing in various parts of the world, tax structures and things like that. But the doctrine itself and what we teach about the doctrine of tithing has never changed. I'd like to read something to you from Mr. Armstrong's autobiography. And this is, he wrote this in 1932. So when did God, if you recall, when God began working with him, when Mr. Armstrong began to understand that the Bible has information about a plan for man, that God is revealing in the pages of the Bible a plan for mankind. Mr. Armstrong began to understand that in 1927 as God began working with him, that God had a particular message. In 1932, he wrote about this incident or this understanding that he came to in the year 1932. So it took him 5 years From the time that God began working with them till he came to this understanding. He said, I have explained in past chapters how after conversion I had come to learn and understand one doctrine at a time. The truth was not acquired all at once. I had known that the Bible had quite a little to say about tithing one's income, yet somehow it had never become completely clear. At about this time, in the little time I had for my work at the newspaper to study the Bible in prayer, and for prayer, I had made a special study of the matter of tithing. We saw, he and his wife saw the mistakes we had been making and started a definite practice of strict tithing. We had only a very little on hand, but we sent a tenth of it, plus an offering, to the Oregon Conference treasurer. That would have been the Church of God Seventh Day. That very day, he writes, now this is in the autobiography under a paragraph entitled, An End to Going Hungry. He said, that very day, the way opened for us to be able to stock up at home with a reasonable abundance of food. For one thing, we had a large, thick steak. My wife cooked it at low heat with the utensils we had acquired when I devoted a year to selling them. I never shall forget that steak. It was way and by far the best steak I have ever tasted. You must have been really hungry for steak at that time. It said, although we were still required to live another 14 years in the barest and most modest financial circumstances, we never from that day had to be actually hungry or miss meals because of financial poverty. We have since heard scores and scores of case histories of the experiences of others who were immediately prospered once they began tithing. But we ourselves lived through this same experience. I'm very grateful to have been privileged to have been instrumental in bringing countless others into this same divine blessing. My wife and I had to learn it the hard way. So within about 5 years of understanding that the Bible has a message for all mankind, Mr. Armstrong came to a better understanding on the subject of tithing and writes about it again in his autobiography. So I thought what I would do would be to take some time today to look through first the Old Testament, to see what the Old Testament biblical record of tithing, and just go through from, you know, Genesis, you know, to Malachi, and look at scriptures that focus on the subject of tithing. And what do we learn? What do we glean from how the subject of tithing is introduced? When you first read about tithing, what does it tell us about it? What do we learn about it? What were the attitudes? Where did the idea of feast tithe, a third tithe for the poor and the needy, where did that all come from? We'll look at scriptures in the Old Testament. And then in the next sermon, next week, I hope to go ahead and then and go through the New Testament and cover the subject as it's discovered there in the New Testament. If in the meantime, if you have any questions related to the subject of tithing, please feel free to send them to me. Send me an email or write me a note, and I'll try to make sure that those get answered in the sermon next week if you have questions about the subject of tithing. But let's begin by going back to Genesis chapter 14. Genesis chapter 14. And see what we can glean here about the subject of tithing. It's not a long account. It's in the account of Abram rescuing his nephew Lot from a group of kings that defeated the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we begin reading here in Genesis 14, verse 10. Now the valley of Siddim was full of asphalt pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, the victorious kings, and all their provisions, and went their way. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, Abram's nephew, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, and brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants, who were born in his own house, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. So here is Abram, with apparently enough means and wealth to have 318 servants that he could then arm with weapons to follow after these kings and to try to rescue his nephew Lot. Quite a substantial. Abram had quite a bit himself to have 318 servants. Verse 15, he divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. So he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. So there were people, there were goods, a lot. People were captured. And Abram was able to rescue all of them and bring them back. He was successful in saving Lot and getting his property back. Let's read in verse 18. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem. We believe, our understanding and belief, that Melchizedek is the one who became Jesus Christ in the New Testament, who was the God of the Old Testament, the Yahweh of the Old Testament, that Israel communicated with, heard from, related to. If you look in Hebrews, you find more about Melchizedek. But in the Hebrew, it is unusual to have a king whose name means King of Righteousness. Melchizedek, King of Righteousness, or King of Peace. And that's in the Hebrew. And it says he brought out bread and wine. Brought out bread and wine. Now, that's not a normal combination. When you bring out food or snacks or refreshments to refresh an army. But in this case, he brought out bread and wine. Certainly, there was some symbolism involved there, because bread and wine are symbols of Passover. And there's certainly a connection there. We'll look at Josephus and see that there was more to it than that. So he brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. This Melchizedek, the priest of God Most High. And he's identified in greater detail in the New Testament. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. So God is the possessor of heaven and earth and everything in the universe. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, Abram, gave him a tithe or tenth of all. First time we read about tithing. It's in the context of this God who is the possessor of everything, that has blessed Abraham and that Abraham wants to worship. And it says he gave him. It doesn't say pay, although the Hebrew simply doesn't make a point of it. The Hebrew doesn't make a point of give or pay at this point. You could pay your tithes by giving an envelope, you know, at a church or in an offering, or giving an envelope to the mailman who sends it to the headquarters office to pay your tithes. The Hebrew just doesn't make a point of give or pay in this case, but here in the King James it's translated as give. And he gave him a tenth of all the spoils of war, food, weapons, whatever there was. Now, we don't read anything about Melchizedek asking Abram to tithe. We just see Abram doing this in conjunction with worshiping God. There's no explanation. There's no introduction. There's no clarification. It looks like an ongoing practice. Abram was familiar with tithing and he tithed. There's no introduction or explanation at all. The account, as I read it, seems to presume that Abram had done this before, that he knew what it was all about. I want to read a quote from Josephus. Josephus was a Jewish historian who was employed by the Roman Empire in, you know, around the first century or so to record the history of the Jews. And in Antiquities of the Jews, Josephus writes this about this incident. He says, so Abram, when he had saved the captive Sodomites who had been taken by the Assyrians, and Lot also his kinsman, returned home in peace. Now the king of Sodom met him at a certain place which they called the King's Dale, where Melchizedek, king of the city Salem, received him. That name signifies the righteous king, and such he was without dispute, insomuch that on this account he was made the priest of God. However, they afterward called Salem Jerusalem. So Melchizedek had been apparently instrumental, and Josephus says that Melchizedek was the first to build a city on the site that later became Jerusalem, that here is called Salem. Now this Melchizedek supplied Abram's army in a hospitable manner and gave them provisions in abundance. Bible just says he gave them bread and wine. And I think there's a symbolic value in that, knowing who Melchizedek was and what the future held as far as the sacrifice of Christ. But Josephus records that he gave him abundant provisions. And as they were feasting, he began to praise him and to bless God for subduing his enemies under him. And when Abram gave him the tenth of part of his prey, he accepted of the gift. When Abram gave him the tenth part of the prey, he accepted of the gift. Just an interesting account, a little bit different than what we find in the scriptures, perhaps adding a few more details. So, according to Josephus, Melchizedek, as I said, was the first to build on a site named Peace, or Salem. First one to build there. If Melchizedek received a tenth, what would he do with it? What would Melchizedek do with a tenth, the tithe? Well, again, I can speculate, but it seems reasonable that if Salem was the site that eventually became the city called Jerusalem, a place of worship, Melchizedek would have used tithes to pay workers to build a city there, a city for the worship of God. A city called Salem, later known as Jerusalem. They would have paid out money to help build, maintain this city called Salem. Also, consider what one of the names that Abraham was called. Abraham is called father of what? Father of the faithful. Father of the faithful. It's an interesting thing to consider that tithing is certainly a regular test of faith, isn't it? It's a regular test of our faith, of how faithful we're going to be to God in that area of our lives. There are some implications, I think, from this story, this Genesis 14 account. Several points just, I think, to glean from it. One, Abraham's tithing is done in the context of God who possesses everything. It's all God's in the first place. And Abraham tithes in the context of God granting him victory and success. Also, in this account, Abraham's tithing appears to be totally voluntary. He wants to do it. We see him doing this to worship and honor God. And in the sense that we choose to honor and worship God, tithing in this case was also voluntary as part of that. Honor and worship of God. A third point. Abraham tithed on all the spoils. Food, jewelry, weapons, whatever it was. He tithed on all of it. Also, it's interesting to me to think about the fact that this occurred before what we would call Abraham's conversion. Before God changed his name to Abraham from Abram. Before God said to Abram, walk before me and be perfect. All of, you know, this happened before that. And so tithing, I think when you ask the question, how is it first introduced in the Bible? It's first introduced in the Bible in this context, as an act of worship, an act of gratefulness for God's protection and God's blessing. And this is what we see Abram doing. Now we need to go to Genesis 27 and 28. For the next mention of tithing and see what may be added here, what else we can learn from the accounts here. Genesis 27, it's the account of Jacob. Remember when Jacob stole his brother Esau's birthright? And the way he did, he deceived their father. And Esau was not happy with this. We read in Genesis 27, verse 41, so Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand, then I will kill my brother Jacob. And the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, surely your brother Esau comforts himself concerning you by intending to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice, arise, flee to my brother Laban in Haran. So the context of what we're going to read next about tithing is in the context of Jacob running for his life from Esau, not sure what his fate was going to be, not sure, you know, other than knowing Esau wants to murder him. And so we read then in Genesis 28, beginning here in verse 10. Now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran, where Laban lived, where his mother said, go. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. Isn't that what you do when you go camping? You just find a rock and lay your head on a rock. And that's your pillow? Well, of course, he would have wrapped it up in a cloak or a garment or something, would have wrapped it up and made a pillow out of it. So then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father. Now notice the promises. He said, the land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth, many descendants. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And in you and in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. A prophecy of the Messiah, that in the coming of the Messiah through this line, all the earth would be blessed. But there would also be a number of physical blessings, descendants, land. Behold, I am with you, Jacob, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. So these tremendous promises from God that Jacob dreams. Here is in vision that God has given him. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Then Jacob arose early in the morning, took the stone that he had put at his head, set it up as a pillar, and poured oil on top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel. Bethel just means house of God. This is where God is dwelling. But the name of the city had been Luz previously. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, so in response to God's promises to him, which were great blessings and promises, in response, Jacob vows several things. If God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. He said, then the God of Abraham and Isaac will be my God, and I will worship this God. That was one thing Jacob promised. And this stone, which I have set as a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. Of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth. Now again, what are the implications? A couple of points, few points for, you know, that I think this account implies. Very similar to what we saw in Abraham's case. Tithing again is shown as voluntary for Jacob. Just as Jacob choosing this God as his God was voluntary, tithing was likewise. Secondly, Jacob vows to tithe and to make this his God in the context of God being his protector and provider. He recognizes God as protector and provider, and in that context makes this vow. A third thing that we can glean from this account, Jacob's tithing is connected to the fact that he knows, he's aware of this God, and he desires to worship this God. And the ceremony he does with the oil and the rock and the promises he makes shows this desire to worship this God and to acknowledge this God. Also, the specific mention of tenth implies Jacob had some previous knowledge of this practice. There's no instruction. There's no clarification. He's just shown as doing this. He knows what he's doing. So he's familiar with it. And finally, once again, this vow was made before Jacob wrestled with God. Remember what happened when Jacob wrestled with God? And God changed his name to Israel. And the same things that he said to Abraham, if you will walk before me, be perfect before me, and I will be your God. You know, and this change of heart signifying this change of heart, that just as God began working with Abraham, changed his name to Abraham, God began working with Jacob in a special way, changed his name to Israel. But all of this happened before that. So two accounts here in the book of Genesis that, in my opinion, have a great deal of relevance for us today. I think even more relevance than the Levitical tithing accounts that we'll read in just a little bit. I think there's more relevance to us today in some ways than the Levitical tithing system when we consider what's going on here. Number one, the parallels between the Melchizedek priesthood and the priesthood of Jesus Christ. Okay, Melchizedek was God's priest on the earth at that time, doing a work of God. Jesus Christ is God's high priest today, in charge of a work, in charge of his church. There is a parallel there. I think, secondly, God was calling Abram and Jacob, working with them as individuals in a way that he didn't deal with, you know, the Israelites as a whole, but he worked with Abraham and Jacob in a special way. Both of them were near the beginning of that, beginning of their spiritual journey. Both of them were near the beginning of that spiritual sojourn when these accounts of tithing are recorded as voluntarily giving as part of their worship of God, as far as how we read them. I think it's important to consider whenever something is introduced in the Bible for the first time, how it's introduced. And the subject of tithing is no different. The tithing is not introduced here in the Bible as a law hanging over Abram's head, but it's introduced in the Bible as an expression of what Abraham wanted to do and what he wanted written in his heart and what he wanted to do in worshiping God. There's no evidence that Abram or Jacob ever asked the question, am I obligated to give a tenth? Do I have to give a tenth? Am I cursed if I don't? We don't find any of that. We find both of them giving a tenth willingly, gratefully, in a worshipful attitude, acknowledging God as their provider and as their protector. And it's in that context that the subject of tithing seems to be introduced. And they both did this before God said to them, walk before me and be perfect. Before this, you know, call it conversion. Before that happened, we see them doing this. There was an attitude. And I think God saw that attitude and respected that attitude. And I think it is important to notice how tithing is introduced in the Bible and what the attitude is surrounding it and why they tithe. Because they worship God and they recognize him as their provider and protector. Now, for the next account, we have to go to a year after the Exodus for a direct reference to tithing. And so we go to Leviticus chapter 27. Leviticus chapter 27. Let's see how it's discussed here. Leviticus chapter 27. And beginning here in verse 30. You can go back and read the whole context, but Leviticus 27 and verse 30. We read, and all the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. So this tithe that is described here is called holy to God. If a man wants at all to redeem any of his tithes, he shall add one-fifth to it. Well, let's stop there for a moment and look again at verse 30. The subject is presented as all, you know, anything that grows out of the soil. Whatever the tithe is, it's God's. It's not mine. It's not yours. It wasn't theirs. They had no jurisdiction over it. Whatever the tithe is, it's God's. And secondly, it's holy. That is, set aside for a special purpose, whatever it is. It was for a special defined purpose. And as we'll see, there were three defined purposes for the tithe. Only two of them are called holy. And we'll see which, you know, as we go through, we'll see what those were. Two of them were called holy. One of them is never referred to as being holy. But there are three defined purposes. Here was a tithe that was holy. It was God's. Verse 31, if a man wants at all to redeem any of his tithes, he shall add one-fifth to it. Now, this has nothing to do with the second or feast tithe. The idea went around the church for a number of years, maybe still does, that, well, I could borrow from my second tithe, from my feast tithe, and use it to pay my bills, use it to do this or do that, as long as I pay it back and then add a fifth to it, a fifth of money, not a fifth of something else, but add a fifth of the tithe to it. And so people have this idea, though, I'll borrow from my tithe, I'll use it to pay this. And what most often happened is people never did give it back, never did pay it back. It was just gone. That's usually what happened when they did that. Some did, but this has nothing to do with the feast tithe or the second tithe. This is totally different from that. Remember, this is an agricultural society. And so they tithe on the grain, the seed, produce. So here a farmer gathers up his tithe of the seed. And he sees that some of that seed is superior seed. He says, you know, if I can pull this out of this tithe and use it for planting, I'll have a superior crop next year and I can give even more to God. And God said that was okay. You could trade the good for the bad in a sense, but you had to add a fifth to it to do that. And that was the context of this. And the idea was that next year's crop would be better. You could do that with seeds. But notice verse 33. Or verse 32, and concerning the tithe of the herd or the flock, or of whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. Every tenth animal was holy to God. Verse 33, he shall not inquire whether it is good or bad, nor shall he exchange it. He can't redeem from the animals the seed he could. And if he exchanges it at all, both it and the one exchanged for it shall be holy. It shall not be redeemed. So he couldn't do the redeeming with the animals. Do it with good or bad seed, but not with animals. God didn't want the tenth altered when it came to animals. So suppose you were a poor country gentleman farmer. Okay, and you had a small flock or a small herd. And you had only five animals. Your tithe did not come due. God said it's not the first animal that passed under the rod, but the tenth. So you had only five animals, so there is no tithe involved until however long it takes to get that tenth animal. You know, when you get the tenth animal, then that tenth animal becomes holy to God, and then it's tithe. Now, why did God do that? Because with my paycheck, I tithe first. I take the tithe out first thing. You know, then I pay the other bills with what's left over, and it's probably what your practice has been, what we've taught, you know, practice what we've done in God's church as long as I can remember. We take the tithe out first and then we use the rest to pay our bills. But I think God understood that the farmers are businessmen, for example, and we'll get to that maybe in the next sermon. Farmers, there was a level of risk involved. You might never achieve that tenth animal. You might never achieve having that tenth animal. There was a level of risk, and God, I think, respected that and took note of that. So here in Leviticus is this passing mention of tithing. And again, there's no introduction. There's no further lengthy explanation of what tithing is. It's more of an administrative statement. When it comes to seed and produce, when it comes to animals, here's how it's done. But it also talks about the tithe being holy to God. Let's go next to Numbers, Numbers chapter 18. Each time we learn a little bit more about God's thinking and how people seem to respond to this. Numbers 18, a very important event takes place, a historic event. In Numbers 18, verse 1 through 4, God ordains the family of Aaron as priests. And he also says the Levites were to serve at the temple. Tabernacle in the wilderness, ultimately the temple. Now again, the priests were different from the Levites. Priests all came from the family of Aaron. Levites were the rest of the tribe. But they had some things in common, but they also had some distinctions between them. Let's read Numbers 18, verse 1. The Lord said to Aaron, you and your sons and your father's house with you shall bear the iniquity related to the sanctuary, the iniquity or the guilt, that is, sacrifice that had to be conducted, things related to the sanctuary, cleansing it, and to the priesthood, your family, the Aaronic family, the priest, would be the priest family of Aaron, shall bear the iniquity related to the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear the iniquity associated with your priesthood. Also, bring with you your brethren of the tribe of Levi, the rest of the tribe, the tribe of your father, that they may be joined with you and serve you while you and your sons are with you before the tabernacle of witness. They shall attend to your needs and all the needs of the tabernacle, but they shall not come near the articles of the sanctuary and the altar, lest they die, they and you also. Now, through the course of Israel's history, there are times when this was violated. And sure enough, they died when they didn't follow this instruction. They shall be joined with you and attend to the needs of the tabernacle of meeting for all the work of the tabernacle. But an outsider shall not come near you. So the priesthood belongs to Aaron and his sons. The rest of the tribe of Levi to assist them. God said the rest of the tribe of Levi did that. They took care of the rest of the tabernacle, Aaron and the priest, the sanctuary, and the altar. Verse 5, and you shall attend to the duties of the sanctuary and the duties of the altar, that there be no more wrath on the children of Israel. So here was a clear distinction between the priest and the Levites, and it was how it functioned. Now God made another distinction. How did they get paid? If you remember, the tribe of Levi had no inheritance. They weren't given any land. They didn't have anything that were a place where they could grow crops and animals and produce for themselves. They had no inheritance among the other tribes. So God begins to give instruction about that. Numbers 18, verse 8. And the Lord spoke to Aaron. Here, I myself have also given you charge of my heave offerings, all the holy gifts of the children of Israel. I have given them as a portion to you and your sons as an ordinance forever. This shall be yours of the most holy things, reserved from the fire. Remember when the offerings were given, a portion of it was burned, but there was a portion that wasn't burned. Okay? And that was given to Aaron and the rest of the priesthood. They could use that for food. It was a way of sustenance. God said it was mine. It was given to me, but I'm giving it to you. Every sin offering, every trespass offering which they render to me shall be most holy for you and your sons. Verse 10. In a most holy place you shall eat it. Every male shall eat it. It shall be holy to you. This also is yours, the heave offering of their gift with all the wave offering of the children of Israel. I have given them to you and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. Everyone who is clean in your house may eat it. They could eat these things. All the best of the oil, the best of the new wine, the grain, their first fruits, which they offer to the Lord, I have given them to you. Whatever first ripe fruit is in their land, which they bring to the Lord shall be yours. Everyone who is clean in your house may eat it. Every devoted thing in Israel shall be yours. Everything that first opens the womb of all flesh which they bring to the Lord, whether man or beast, shall be yours. Nevertheless, the firstborn of man you shall surely redeem, and the firstborn of unclean animals you shall redeem. Those things could be bought back, a price paid, so you didn't have to, give your son to the priest if you didn't want to. You could redeem your son or an unclean animal. Okay, but God was saying how he would begin to provide for Aaron and his family, even though they had no inheritance. Verse 20, then the Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land, nor shall you have any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the children of Israel. So God said, I will give you what you need. To Aaron and the priest. What about the rest of the Levites? Did Aaron and his family have to say, okay, now how are we going to pay those guys? No, God's going to take care of us, but how do we pay the Levites? So God instructs Aaron what to say and what to do. Verse 21, behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel. God is instructing Aaron. So Aaron, tell the Levites, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work which they perform, the work of the tabernacle of meeting. So the tithe was given to Levi for their sustenance because they had no inheritance, no land. Notice verse 24. For the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer up as a heave offering to the Lord, holy to God, I have given to the Levites as an inheritance. Therefore, I have said to them among the children of Israel, they shall have no inheritance. So God didn't expect Aaron and his sons to pay for the upkeep of the whole tribe from the portion of the offering that came to the priests. That was just a small amount. there was more that also went to the priests. And now God tells Moses. He says, Moses, I want you to tell the Levites something else about how else they help the priests. Aaron told the priests how they were going to get paid. But now Moses said, you tell the Levites how the priests are going to get paid. And so this happens, verse 25. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak thus to the Levites and say to them, when you take from the children of Israel the tithe which I have given you from them as your inheritance, then you shall offer up a heave offering of it to the Lord, a tenth of the tithe. And your heave offering shall be reckoned to you as though it were the grain of the threshing floor and as the fullness of the winepress. Just like the people who raise crops, then tithe on it. He said, just like they, you tithe on what the people give to you. Verse 28, thus you shall offer a heave offering to the Lord from all your tithes, which you receive from the children of Israel, and you shall give the Lord's heave offering from it to Aaron the priest. So the Levites are considered like one of the other tribes, and they have to tithe. And that tithe was given to the priests. People gave it to God. God gave it to the Levites, and the Levites had to give a tenth to the priests. And that was, again, how their income. So it's just interesting to me that a more gracious way of doing this, instead of God having Aaron tell the Levites, look, give a tithe to us, God has Moses tell the Levites, you give a tithe to the priests. And so the priests were sustained by the part of the offering that wasn't burned up and the tithe from the Levites. The Levites were sustained by a tithe from the people. And that tithe was holy to God. And it was to do the work of that time, the work of the tabernacle, the work in the sanctuary. Verse 31, you may eat it in any place, you and your households. It is your reward for your work in the tabernacle of meeting. A tithe that could be eaten at home by the priests, by the Levites. And that's important to keep in mind. A tithe that could be eaten at home by the priests and the Levites for their sustenance. Let's stop there and think a little bit about this. I mentioned that I thought there was a great deal of relevance to the two accounts in Genesis for us today in tithing. What about the Levitical tithing system? We have used the analogy. Is it a valid analogy that we've made the analogy of the Levites analogous to the ministry today? Is that a valid analogy? Why or why not? Think again about how God works. In place of the Levitical priesthood, there is no Levitical priesthood today in the work that God is doing. We don't sacrifice at the tabernacle. We don't kill animals. We don't, we have Christ's sacrifice to wash away iniquity. There is no Levitical priesthood today, Jesus Christ. There is the priesthood of Jesus Christ, who is our high priest. Jesus Christ, who was Melchizedek, who was the Yahweh of the Old Testament, the one that Israel communicated with, Jesus Christ of the New Testament. He is authorized to take tithes, as historically, as Melchizedek, as the God of the Old Testament, and as Jesus Christ today. The ultimate recipient of the tithe remains the same, Melchizedek, the spokesman, the high priest of God's kingdom that's going to be established, the ultimate recipient of the tithe is the same. Under Moses and the Levitical priesthood, God authorized those who did his work on the earth. Who was authorizing it? The one who became Jesus Christ. Authorized those who did his work on the earth to take tithes. We believe that Christ's ministry today is doing the work along with the people of God, but the work of preaching the gospel to the world, taking the gospel to the world, and that there is a ministry today that is parallel to the Levitical system in the sense of doing a work of God and teaching the truth of God today. Tithing in the Bible has always been God's basic support system, which he has used throughout history to support whatever work he did. Going all the way back to Melchizedek building a city called Jerusalem from which to worship God, it was tithes, undoubtedly, that built that. To the Levitical priesthood, and the sacrifices at the tabernacle and later the temple. It was tithes in support of that, and we believe likewise the work of God today is supported by tithing. So, you know, not everybody would agree that there is a valid analogy there, but that's up to the individual and their relationship with God to look at the scriptures and prove it. And this is where, though, some of these concepts and ideas came from these scriptures and others. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12, the next mention of tithing occurs when Moses addresses a new generation. The old generation had all died in the wilderness. They had not been faithful to God. They rebelled, as you recall. They would not heed what God said he would do for them, promises, the way that Abraham did, the way that Jacob did. They saw only the dangers and the negative. They all died in the wilderness. And now Moses is addressing a new generation in Deuteronomy chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. Again, more about tithing than you probably ever wanted to know, but like I said, I thought it would be good to go through the scriptures and the foundation today, and then we'll look at the New Testament next time. Deuteronomy 12:1. These are the statutes and judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. As you're about to go into the promised land, think about this. Here's what God is doing. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree, the groves, all the places where they worship their gods. Destroy all those places. And you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. All the things that human beings did in the pagan worship of their gods. God said, I want that all wiped out. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things, but you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling place, and there you shall go. So God says, when you get to the promised land, you will have a place to worship where God dwells. And God will reveal that and make it known where his name is. Worship there, not in this place, in this grove, and up on top of that mountain place. No, God will tell you, and you will have a location to worship. So in that context, we read verse 6 and 7. There you shall take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hand, again the plural, your tithes, your vowed offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God. You shall rejoice in all to which you have put your hand, you and your household, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. We know historically the Jews went up to Jerusalem. Israel came to Jerusalem to worship God. They came for the feast days, came for the holy days. It was there that they gave their tithe that supported the Levites. It was there that they ate a tithe related to the festivals. You know, we'll see as we go along. The word in verse 6, anybody ever, well, the Septuagint version. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So we're reading the Old Testament, Hebrew translated into English. But the Hebrew was also translated into Greek. It's called the Septuagint. Here in Deuteronomy 12, verse 6, the word for tithe, the Greek is, the anglicized Greek is D-E-K-A-T-O-N, decaton. Just means a tenth, or the tenth, or tithe. D-E-K-A-T-O-N. Again, maybe more detail than you want, but it's the Septuagint translates this word tithe as decaton. Okay, so keep that in mind. Let's read on in verse 17. Now, he says, you may not eat within your gates the tithe of your grain or your new wine or your oil or the firstborn of your herd or your flock or of any of your offerings which you vow or your freewill offerings or of the heave offering of your hand. Here's a tithe they could not eat within their gates. They had to go to the city of worship, Jerusalem in this case, to eat this tithe. Something different about this one. and there is that that's different. They could eat it only there in that city. But here the word tithe is a different Greek word. It still has the word decaton in it, but if you check out the Septuagint, it's E-P-I-D-E-K-A-T-O-N. I guess you pronounce it epidecaton. The word epi in the Greek just means additional or another. So here is a tithe that is called the, in the Greek, the additional tithe. And it's totally different. It's a revised Greek word from decaton. Verse 18, but you must eat them before the Lord your God in the place which the Lord your God chooses. You and your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, and the Levite who is within your gates, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all to which you put your hands. Take heed to yourself that you do not forsake the Levite as long as you live in the land. So this tithe was to be eaten only in a specific place. They were to see to it that some of these other folks got there as well. They were not to be forsaken. There's no indication that this is the Levitical inheritance. This is not because only the Levites and the priests could eat that tithe that was their inheritance. That was for them. It was holy to God. And it was only for them. This second or this additional tithe is nowhere described as holy. That word holy in some translations actually is the word taboo. Taboo meaning it was taboo to them. They couldn't put their hands on it. They couldn't have it for themselves. This tithe was not taboo to the people. The tithe for the priests and Levites was taboo. It was holy. Only the priests and Levites could participate in that one. This one here was nobody's inheritance. This was the epidecaton, an additional tithe that they could eat in a certain place. Now, the next mention of tithing is in Deuteronomy 14. And this develops what we've been looking at in Deuteronomy 12 to a greater degree. But Deuteronomy 14 starts off in verse 1 and 2. It's a reminder from God. Now remember, he's talking to Israel as they're about to go into the promised land. And it's about how do they conduct themselves, how tithing is administered, how to treat the poor. You know, how to, all kinds of things. God said, when you go into the promised land, this is what I want you to remember. He says, verse 1, you are the children of the Lord God, of the Lord your God, shall not cut yourself nor shave the front of your head for the dead. These were religious ceremonies. Somebody wants to shave his head, go ahead. If you like that look, your wife is okay with it, go ahead and shave your head. But this was in the religious sense of it, a religious connotation. It was part of a religious ceremony that they were not to do those things, to cut themselves and leave scars and markings that were part of a religious observance. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. So conduct yourselves this way. And God then goes through a whole list of things. And included in this, beginning in verse 22, he starts talking about the tithe again. Verse 22, you shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. Here was a tithe every year. The Greek word here is that same word, decaton, D-E-K-A-T-O-N. The Septuagint translates it, decaton. Verse 23. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the epidecaton, that additional tithe. The tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. This was an additional tithe that they could eat. Verse 24. But if the journey is too long for you, so you're not able to carry the tithe of the place where the Lord your God chooses, put his name is too far from you when the Lord your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses. And you shall spend the money for whatever your heart desires. Oxen, sheep, wine, similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. The first tithe for the Levites and priests, Only they could eat, the Levites and priests. Here was a tithe that people kept in their household. They kept with them, and they took it with them, and they could eat. This was not someone's inheritance. They could spend this all on themselves. Verse 27, you shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part nor inheritance with you. So, again, this was not the Levite's inheritance. This was a different tithe. They kept this in their own homes. This was not taboo to them. They could have their hands on it and use it to eat when they went to the feast and traveled to the feast. Verse 28, at the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it within your gates. Now think about that. Here was a tithe that was stored within the walls of their city. It stayed in their city. Why then is the word, and this, you know, raises question for some, the word here, tithe, in verse 28, is the same Greek word, epadeketon. And so people ask, well, isn't this just the second or feast tithe that every third year was applied to given to the poor and the needy? Or is this indeed a third different distinct tithe? Hold your place here. We'll come back. But let's go to Deuteronomy 26 for a moment. So something interesting in Deuteronomy 26 and verse 12. Deuteronomy 26 verse 12. When you have finished laying aside all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your gates and be filled. When you have finished laying aside all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing. The word tithe here is, interestingly enough, a third different word in the Greek. It's not deketon, if you jotted that down. It's not epadeketon, if you jotted that down. It's deuteron, from which we get Deuteronomy. What does Deuteronomy mean? It means an additional or a second telling. In this case, the word deuteron epadeketon is used to describe this tithe. Literally, it would be called a second additional tithe. D-E-U-T-E-R-O-N, deuteron, like Deuteronomy. Deuteron epadeketon, a second additional tithe. That was for the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your gates and be filled. This was something the poor ate within the gates of the city. They didn't go to the feast to eat this one. This was a second additional tithe. We go back to Deuteronomy chapter 14, and again, look at this, verse 28, at the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates of that year, a tenth of 1 year, a tenth of that 1 year that was stored within the gates. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, the Levite, if he had a need, could benefit from this tithe. And the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. God said there was a blessing for those who provided this tithe for the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, within their gates. This was laid up in the town, kept in the town locally, not taken to the city of worship, not kept in one's home for the feast, but for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and even the Levite on an emergency or need basis. God left this to be collected and administered locally. And historically, in our modern history, with third tithe in the Church of God, we've done the same thing. Now, we did send it into a central location, but then we dispersed it, distributed it locally, so that it was fair. Otherwise, you could have a situation where a congregation of 500, their third tithe supported three widows. And a congregation of 100, their third tithe supported 10 widows. And, you know, it's not quite equitable, is it? And so we all sent our third tithe to headquarters, and then it was administered locally. The local pastor made decisions about how it was given out locally, based on the local needs of the individuals. And members then would receive a check from the church monthly, you know, regular third tithe check from third tithe that was sent in. People would be, that was their income. The minister sat down with them, went through a budget and said, here's, you know, okay, does this sound reasonable? Yeah, sounds reasonable. Send that in to headquarters and that would begin the process of a monthly check coming to that widow or to that, mother with children who couldn't work. Or in some cases, handicapped or injured. They were supported by the third tithe. And in the third and sixth years, brethren, when they were in their third and sixth year, we decided to count that from the time of their baptism because there was no way of knowing. You know, where were we in God's 7-year and 50-year cycle? And so people in the third tithe year did that and had experience with what it says at the end of verse 29. That the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. People were blessed. They talked about third tithe year blessings. Now let's go back to Deuteronomy 26 again and look at that where it talks about that year of tithing. Deuteronomy 26 verse 12 and 13, when you have finished laying aside all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your gates and be filled. Then you shall say before the Lord your God, I have removed the holy tithe from my house. This was a holy tithe. The first tithe for the Levites was called holy. The third tithe for the poor was called holy. The second or feast tithe was not holy in the sense that it was not taboo. The people who saved it could eat it and use it for going to the festivals. I have removed the holy tithe from my house, and have also given them to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandments, which you have commanded me. I have not transgressed your commandments, nor have I forgotten them. It's an interesting description of that tithe, that third tithe. God left this to be collected and administered locally. And that's how it was done. This tithe was holy, or hallowed, or taboo to them. They couldn't keep it in their homes. They couldn't use it for themselves. But it was used in the city for those who had need. Now again, there's people who look at these verses and say, well, I don't see three tithes there. I see two. I see feast tithe, and then every third and sixth year, the feast tithe was used for the poor, and people just didn't go to the feast that year. I've thought about that, and just from a logical point of view, are there benefits that God has given us for going to the feast every year? Does God want us to go to the feast every year? What does it do for us spiritually? Would it make sense to give up going to the feast a year because that was a third tithe year, and so you use your feast tithe to pay third tithe and didn't go to the feast that year? I guess I don't see that. That doesn't make sense to me, but I guess to some it could. But I'd like to read a little bit more, a few items from history and from other accounts about how the Jews and how this system of tithing was understood and practiced by the people who were much closer to it by a couple thousand years than we are today. First, a quote from Unger's Bible Dictionary. From all this, it's under the subject of tithing. If you have an Unger's, go home and check it out. From all this, we gather, number one, that one-tenth of the whole produce of the soil was to be assigned to the maintenance of the Levites, that out of this, the Levites were to dedicate a tenth to God for the use of the high priest, the first tithe. That a tithe, in all probability, a second tithe, was to be applied to festival purposes. And third, that in every third year, either this festival tithe or a third tenth was to be eaten in company with the poor and the Levites. The question arises, were there three tithes taken in this third year, or is the third tithe only the second under a different description? He says it must be allowed that the third tithe is not without support. Josephus distinctly says that one-tenth was to be given to the priests and Levites, one-tenth to be applied to the feasts, and that a tenth besides these was every third year to be given to the poor. And then Unger's expresses their opinion, but we don't think that's what it meant. I mean, they say, we think it's unlikely there are actually three. The people would give 30% of their income, in that third tithe year. However, they say, but it's not without support. So they mentioned Josephus, so I went to Josephus. Here's what Josephus says in the Antiquities. He says, let there be taken out of your fruits a tenth besides that which you have allotted to give to the priests and Levites. The tenth of the priests and Levites, the first tithe. But he said, one beside that. This you may indeed sell in the country, but it is to be used in those feasts and sacrifices that are to be celebrated in the holy city. For it is fit you should enjoy those fruits of the earth which God has given you to possess. The feast tithe and the second tithe. And then he says this, besides these two tithes, which I have already said you are to pay every year, the one for the Levites, the other for the festivals, you are to bring every third year a third tithe to be distributed to those that want. And this is how Josephus understood the system of tithing. Dake's annotated reference Bible, one more I'll quote, says this. The three tithes were, first tithe for the Levites, this was a yearly tithe. Second tithe for the individual himself and his household to cover expenses at the national feast, so there would be no excuse for not going. This was also a yearly tithe, though not counted as giving to others. And third tithe for the Levites, the strangers, the fatherless, and widows. It was a special tithe for the poor, a charity tithe, to relieve suffering of poor neighbors. This was to be given only every third year, so it was not a burden in any degree. God more than made up for it in his blessings of prosperity on the crops and stock of the whole nation. God would still do the same today and has done the same in the lives of individuals who have done this. Spread out over the three-year period, the yearly tax for the poor would amount to 3 1/3% of the nation's increase. It was not to be taken to the place of worship as the other two tithes, but distributed locally as needed throughout the 3 years that it covered. So there is support for the understanding of three distinct tithes. There is scriptural support for it. There is historical support. And then it's up to us to decide, well, you know, does that ring true? Our teaching has never changed. Third tithe is still in effect today. But as you know, an administrative decision was made back in 1996. You may recall an incident years ago, Mr. Armstrong spoke about it, about a gentleman, a doctor who was quite a wealthy man. He was in one of the Scandinavian countries where they take almost all of your income for taxes, and from that they pay for your education, they pay for your health benefits, they pay for, you know, a lot of your stuff, but they take your income in form of taxation. This man was in an 80% tax bracket. Now the 20% that he had left was quite a bit. He was, again, fairly wealthy, but he was in an 80% tax bracket. And his question to Mr. Armstrong was, what do I do in the third tithe? That's 110% of my income. And so Mr. Armstrong said, you know, that's impossible. That's ridiculous. You know, the man can't do that. So, no, he shouldn't pay the third tithe because it's just, you know, he couldn't do that. You know, pay his first tithe. But even if he did second tithe, it would still be 100% of his income then. So God said, you know, so Mr. Armstrong said, you know, our advice is pay your first tithe and then save enough to go to the feast because otherwise you're giving 100% of your income. That's impossible. Mr. Armstrong made an administrative decision. When it came to third tithe, this is what we said about the third tithe in 1996. Where governments provide programs, the intent and purpose of which is to provide for the needs of those, the biblical third tithe was designed to assist, and that where such programs are funded by an annual rate of taxation greater than the biblical third tithe, that is the case in the United States. It was then and it is now. Greater than the biblical third tithe, members are not obligated to pay what amounts to an additional third tithe, since there will always be members of the church whose needs will not be adequately provided for by national government social programs, and since the clear example of the scripture is that the church care for its members in need, those members of the church who are able are encouraged to contribute to the church assistance fund so that the biblical injunction to care for the needy within the church can be fulfilled. And so many have continued doing that on the memo line of their check. They write the amount that's first tithe, the amount that may be an offering, and an amount that is for either emergency fund or church assistance fund or poor fund, whatever you want to call it. People still do that. Some have chosen to continue paying third tithe in their third and sixth years in a 7-year time frame. Some have chosen to do that despite the high taxation in our country. But we've made that your choice, how you handle that matter of third tithe, given the tax structure in the United States today, and encourage people to give an offering to the emergency or to the church assistance fund. I want to conclude here in the book of Malachi. taken long enough time for this, but here in Malachi chapter 1. Malachi was a prophet. Malachi wrote about end time events, but he also recorded some of the history that was going on in Israel at that time, and what he saw disturbed him greatly. And so we read in Malachi 1 verse 1, the burden, interesting phrase, or the prophecy or oracle, but in the New King James it translates it, the burden of the words of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. So words to Israel. Israel today is Israelite countries today, United States, England, others, you know, in prophecy. We know who the Israelite countries are. So it was a word to them at that time, but also a prophecy for us today. And what was going on? What was the burden? What was the problem? We read in Malachi 2 verse 1, and now, O priests, so addressed to the priest and the Levites, this commandment is for you. If you will not hear, and if you will not take it to heart to give glory to my name, whatever they were doing wasn't giving glory to God's name. Says the Lord of hosts, I will send a curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Yes, I have cursed them already, because you do not take it to heart. Behold, I will rebuke your descendants and spread refuse on your faces. That's an ugly thought. The refuse of your solemn feasts, and one will take you away with it, ultimately into captivity. Then you shall know that I have sent this commandment to you, that my covenant with Levi may continue, says the Lord of hosts. To the priests and the Levites, they were neglecting their responsibility toward God and their responsibility and duty to the people of God as far as teaching God's truth and God's way. They lacked fear of God. They lacked respect for God. And Malachi wrote about this. And then in chapter 3, verse 5, it wasn't just the priests. Malachi 3, verse 5. And I will come near you for judgment. I will be a swift witness against sorcerers, apparently sorcerers in the land, against adulterers, against perjurers, against those who exploit wage earners and widows and orphans, and against those who turn away an alien because they do not fear me, says the Lord of hosts. So the people, in addition to the priests and Levites, weren't fearing God, weren't doing their part. So in that context, we read verse 8. Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me, but you say, in what way have we robbed you? The answer, in tithes and offerings. In the context of what's going on here, God introduced the subject of tithes and offerings and says, will a man rob God? He didn't say, will a man rob Levi or Aaron? He says, will a man rob God? And he defines withholding of their tithes as robbery, which is a violation of the eighth commandment, which says you shall not steal. He says they were stealing from God and that it was sin because they were stealing. They were breaking the eighth commandment in robbing and stealing from God. Verse 9, you are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse that there may be food in my house. Try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing, there will not be room enough to receive it. Bring all the tithes, or the whole nation would be cursed. And we certainly see that in our case today. What was Malachi? He was a historian. He was recording the history of his day, the problems. He was also a prophet, defining a problem and problems in the end time. And in the historic context, as you read through, Malachi describes moral, spiritual issues, aspects related to the worship of God and the right attitude in worshiping God and serving God that were timeless, ageless principles that Malachi said were important. But in the prophetic message, he addresses the subject of tithes and offerings and defines withholding that as sin, and that God would condemn or curse the nation, and it was not confined just to their day, but to the time of our nation today as well. So we'll stop there, covering the Old Testament on the subject of tithing. Again, if you have questions, send them to me in an email, write it down, give it to me. I'll try to include answers to that in the sermon that I give next time. on the subject of tithing in the New Testament, try to answer some of those specific questions. I hope the overview is helpful. Like I said, probably more about tithing than you ever wanted to know. But I think it is important to understand the background and the foundation and where these things came from. They were not just made up by men who wanted, you know, to enrich themselves. There are timeless, ageless principles and statutes related to the subject of tithing that we find in the Old Testament. And next time we'll do that going through the New Testament.